This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Just over 2 weeks ago, a terrible new ritual began near the small town of Paradise, California. Late in the afternoon, local officials walk up to a microphone and give an update.
And so today, an additional 6 human remains were recovered. Today, during the course of our searches, an additional 8 human remains were recovered.
The number of people who are still looking for or unaccounted for has increased to 600.
More than 10,000 homes in Paradise burned to the ground in what's become known as a campfire. It's the worst wildfire in state history. We won't know the final death count until emergency personnel can complete their search. Hundreds of people went missing. The fire started at about 6:30 in the morning on November 8th in a remote area about 15 miles outside of Paradise.
Possibly in the area of Camp Creek Road. RP was calling.
And it moved very quickly.
There is a possible power line hazard.
Overwhelming residents and emergency responders.
We are inundated with 911s right now, unable to do anything but meet the assistance. We'll try to help.
KQED's Suki Lewis has been listening to dispatch calls and piecing together a timeline of what happened in the first minutes and hours of the campfire. She joins us. Hey, Suki.
Hey, Al.
So how did this fire get out of control so quickly?
Well, it was the conditions. It was really windy and hot and dry, but it was also the location of where this fire sparked. It was way out down this rural road that was nearly impassable. And the first firefighter to respond drives out as close as he can get. He gets eyes on the fire within 10 minutes of the first report. But he can tell by looking at it that fighting this fire is going to be really, really tough.
Eyes on the vegetation fire. It's going to be very difficult to access. Camp Creek Road is nearly inaccessible.
So they can't get to it. He actually sends another firefighter to scout out a way to get to the fire. But in the meantime, they decide they need to evacuate this little tiny town called Polga.
Yeah, we've made notifications in Polga, and then we're coming out.
Now, while all of this is going on, were people alerted in the town of Paradise?
So people in the town of Paradise had not gotten alerts as of 8 a.m. They send out these first alerts at that point and, you know, declare a mandatory evacuation for many areas in Paradise. But again, this is an opt-in system, and we do know that the sheriff did not use the wireless emergency alerts that, you know, kind of could have let everybody know pretty quickly that this was going on. Those are those amber-style alerts that hijack your phone and make a loud noise. So many people did not get alerts, and they have to keep expanding these evacuation orders even as they're trying to get people out of them.
All units, be advised, the town of Paradise is under a mandatory evacuation. The town of Paradise is under a mandatory evacuation.
So mandatory evacuations means that law enforcement starts going door to door to get people out, right?
Yeah, so they're going door to door, but already there are reports of people who are getting trapped, including firefighters and first responders. You know, on the tape, I heard so many of these reports of first responders getting stuck inside the fire line, and they had to evacuate hospitals, schools, and even once first responders made it into people who are trapped, they still had to get them out to safety.
So I've read that Paradise actually did have plans for evacuation. Did that help streamline this incident?
Their plans were pretty much overwhelmed. As everybody rushed to get out of town, traffic becomes this huge problem. And they try to shut down the main arteries leading out of town to have all traffic going outbound to help people escape from the fire. But even just setting that up becomes really chaotic. You know, people are abandoning their cars. At one point, they have to actually take another giant truck to push cars out of the way to clear the way for residents who are trying to stream out of this town and escape from this fire. And the next big problem that I see, Al, is that people can't get in to help. And as we know now, many people did not make it out.
In some ways, hearing this unfold, it brings this horrible feeling of deja vu. I mean, just last year when we talked about the worst wildfires in state history, the North Bay firestorm.
Yes, and so many issues are the same. Like, as a reporter, for me, in many ways, it feels like I'm having to tell the same story over again, from the evacuation alerts that are not getting out to, you know, many of the people who are the victims of this fire who are elderly and disabled. And it's just heartbreaking.
Suki's been covering more of these fires because, well, they keep getting worse. Last year at this time, she and her colleagues at KQED, Marisa Lagos and Lisa Pickoff White, reported on a fire that scorched wine country in Napa and Sonoma counties. They found that emergency response systems, including CAL FIRE, the state agency that responds to wildfire, aren't built to keep up with the fires that are burning hotter and faster than ever before. We're going to listen back to that story and then dig into some of the lessons learned. Marisa starts us off in the hills above Sonoma County's biggest city, Santa Rosa.
Greg and Christina Wilson spend October 8th puttering around their house. It's close to coffee shops and grocery stores, but from here, all you see are treetops and grassy hillsides.
On Sundays, we hang out at home. You know, I'm always working, so I was probably doing work and watching football, whatever.
They're in their early 50s. She's a mortgage advisor. He's a lawyer. They have a 2-year-old dog, a Shih Tzu named Maximus. Max for short. They live in a tight-knit neighborhood up on a hill where neighbors take time to chat. And after years of work remodeling, the house finally felt fully theirs.
It feels like, you know, you're just in this, you know, serene setting so far away. This is like our dream.
On that Sunday, Christina stands in her new bright kitchen, looking out of the windows.
It was a lot windier than normal, and it was very warm. It was a warm day.
Christina doesn't think much of the wind, but what she doesn't realize is that wind will soon bring fire to her doorstep. Inside the CAL FIRE war room, they're worried that something like that could happen. Suki takes us there, where officials are already on standby.
Firefighters are ready to mobilize because the National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning, the highest alert for fire danger. Then, around 7:30 in the evening, 911 dispatchers get a concerning call.
Fire medical dispatch. Hey, it's County. I'm transferring a caller who's reporting. It sounds like a power line that was arcing.
Okay.
Sir?
Yes.
Go ahead. What is the address of the emergency?
The man tells the dispatcher that winds knocked a power line into a tree.
There are a lot of sparks, and this is a super high fire danger area. So, but the power lines were definitely emitting sparks.
Okay.
What's that?
Yeah.
Okay.
The dispatcher says someone is on the way, then makes this a top priority. She consults a computer screen to send the nearest engine out to respond. But the wind keeps picking up. About 20 minutes later, a woman dials 911 to report a transformer blowing miles away.
I'm sorry, tell me again what happened?
Well, it looked like it was a big firework that went off,
okay.
But I'm pretty sure it's a transformer.
All right. We do have the fire department on the way. Stay safe and out of danger.
What's happening here is that high winds are knocking down power lines. These send out sparks, starting little fires. Then as lines go down, the electricity needs to go somewhere, so it gets redistributed. This overloads other lines, creating power surges. Transformers explode, taking down more of the electrical grid.
Power lines are down. Request PTD. One charge will be addressed in about 20 minutes.
As CAL FIRE gets these reports, they contact PG&E, the local utility company. And together, they have the ability to do a few things. the utility can send out linemen to deal with individual incidents, or shut down power remotely, or a combination of both.
But due to power lines, the northbound shoulder is going to be on fire until PG&E can secure power for us.
On that night, CAL FIRE and PG&E go by procedure, dealing with these incidents one by one, relying on linemen. They can't keep up.
Information, we have multiple 911s ringing and not being able to answer.
This is when you can first hear things getting out of control. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. CAL FIRE's map is getting crowded. They're running out of people to send, even as new fires break out.
Right to the point where CAL FIRE told us they've got no more resources, can't send to anybody.
With no one to send to put out all these small fires, two blazes explode almost simultaneously, about 30 miles apart. In the forested hills of Sonoma County, gusts of wind are sweeping up burning tree branches and debris and hurling these embers miles through the air. The blaze starts jumping from one mountain peak to another, leapfrogging valleys, racing through Napa vineyards, and devouring homes across both counties. And it's now rushing toward the city of Santa Rosa, home to 175,000 people.
And for firefighters, it's becoming clear these fires they're facing are of a different order.
Multiple structures involved.
CAL FIRE Captain Jeff Hoag is in the middle of all of this. He's like the voice of God to his troops. All night long, firefighters hear him on the radio, taking their calls and coordinating their response. From the CAL FIRE war room, Hoag sends out a reminder, crackling over the radio.
The priority of the unit is safety of the public, rescue, as well as safety of the rescuer. Do what you can.
Safety for the public. Safety for the rescuer. Do what you can.
What that means is putting out fires isn't the priority anymore. For firefighters, the singular focus is saving human lives, including their own. At 10:30, CAL FIRE starts calling local law enforcement agencies in Napa and Sonoma to initiate evacuations. In this game of telephone, you can hear a lot go wrong.
Hi, it's Michelle.
I need a reverse 911 done.
Okay.
So CAL FIRE needs it for the Calistoga area, mandatory evacuations.
This CAL FIRE employee is asking a Napa operator for a reverse 911. That's an evacuation alert that can target specific neighborhoods, warning people fire is approaching. It calls home phones, but only about half of Americans have landlines these days.
Copy. We'll advise CAL FIRE.
Okay.
Okay. I'm sorry. What's your question?
Okay. So you say reverse 911. Are you aiming Nixall or?
I need you guys to send out a reverse 911 so we can tell them to evacuate.
Okay. I'm not familiar with what a reverse 911 is. I'm sorry.
This is another one of those places where you can hear the system breaking down. The operator doesn't even know what CAL FIRE is talking about. But that's actually because each county in California, there are 58, uses different technologies with different names to alert people. To CAL FIRE, it's reverse 911. To Napa, it's called Nixall.
I think it's just Nixall.
Okay.
If it's going out to the public and everyone.
Yeah, it needs to go to all their phones, landline and everything. Mandatory
landline.
And evacuation, okay. Yeah.
In this call, CAL FIRE is requesting an evacuation order. But it still takes an hour before law enforcement officials in Napa issue text alerts to the public. They won't call people on their landlines until the next day. Over the course of the night, delay and confusion happen again and again.
Right, and it didn't just happen in Napa. Back at the home of Christina and Greg Wilson, the phone rings around 10 at night. But it's not Sonoma County officials calling.
Yeah, I got a phone call around 10 o'clock from one of my friends who lives about 3 miles away. And she's like, you know, I see fire in the distance and it looks like it's coming really close.
They look out the window and can see a faint glow of fire. Christina's husband Greg chats with the neighbors and prepares to leave. Just in case, they fill two cars with valuables, a new painting, dog treats for Max. All the while, that fire in the distance, fueled by high winds, is burning much closer. Soon, it's right at the end of their street.
Then all of a sudden, it was like just coming on so close that everybody at the same time decided to leave.
They get in their cars and start driving. Their neighbors are all trying to get out, too. and the narrow road is clogged with traffic. Flames surround them.
I was just, thought, let's turn around.
The fire keeps growing as they head back home. And when they get there, their house is on fire, too. So they go to the one place where the flames can't reach.
So Greg said, let's just get in the pool. And it made sense because it just did.
In their swimming pool, Christina and Greg are safe from the flames, but not the smoke or the air, superheated to an excess of 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
That was such superheated air that trying to breathe it was so hard.
That air is so hot, it consumes the oxygen before they can catch a breath. It burns their lungs, and it's why Greg's voice sounds so hoarse. Greg holds Maximus, their dog. He squeezes Christina's hand as they dive under the water.
Really, just those first 20 minutes, it's diving down, coming up, sometimes not really getting any air at all, but just saying, okay, I gotta go down again.
They plunge into the freezing cold water again and again, just to get a break from the blaze. The solar panels bubble and burst. Greg watches as their dream home turns to ash. The fire's creating its own weather, whipping debris all over the place. Flying embers hit Maximus in the eye.
And right then, it's like, you have time to talk to each other and say, this could be it, honey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then, I know we did it a couple more times, you know.
It meant the world because, oh my God, because we were all together.
And that was probably why we didn't leave, because I couldn't bear the thought of separating. You know, if we drove down and one of us made it and one of us didn't, I'd rather us be together.
I didn't even think of that. You know, I just didn't think we would have a chance to survive.
It's at this point that authorities send out the first evacuation orders. This call went out at 11:30 p.m.
Attention, Sonoma County residents. There is a large fire off Mark West Springs Road. There are several homes engulfed in flames. We are recommending that you prepare to evacuate your homes and go to safe areas at this point.
That call goes out as the Wilsons are huddling together in the water. Their cell phones on the side of the pool have melted into a pile of metal and splintered glass.
Only about 1,200 people who live in the hills above Santa Rosa receive that initial evacuation call. As the fire moves out of the wildlands, racing towards densely populated neighborhoods, most people are asleep in their beds and have no idea what's coming. When we come back, Sugi and Marisa take us into the neighborhoods where people are waking up to a wall of flames. This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Throughout the country, wildfires are getting more extreme. And in California, this year's fires have proven deadlier and more destructive than ever. These blazes share many of the same characteristics as the firestorm that ripped through Northern California's wine country last October, which, at the time, were the deadliest in state history. KQED reporters Lisa Pickoff-White, Marisa Lagos, and Suki Lewis are looking back at last year's fires and what we can learn from the crucial decisions that were made in the first hours of those disasters. We join Suki in the hills above the city of Santa Rosa, where a sheriff's deputy is stumbling through the dark, choking on smoke, trying to get residents to safety.
Sheriff's office!
This is audio from a sheriff deputy's body cam. In the dark, two officers pound on doors, yelling at people to get out.
Come on, she's disabled.
They come across a woman who can't walk.
Let me get her feet. Let me get her feet.
They carry her out of her house to their squad car by her arms and legs.
Watch your leg, watch your leg, watch your leg. Watch your leg, watch your leg.
As the deputy drives out, he can barely see out of his windshield. It's just smoke and embers.
Go, 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 go! Drive! Go!
Rescuers will not get to every door. On this night, at least 8 people will end up dying along this road. At another point in the video, just around midnight, the officer gets on the radio to ask about a neighborhood to the west.
We got to keep pushing the evacuations as far west as we can.
He's telling dispatchers they need to expand evacuations, pushing towards a neighborhood in Santa Rosa called Fountain Grove.
Fire. We got to be ready to evacuate all the way to 101 in my mind.
At 1 a.m., this man calls to report a winery in Fountain Grove is on fire.
Winery. I'm talking about, I'm watching it right now. It's burning right towards us.
Okay. I need you to leave the area then.
Despite many calls like this, it would be another hour, nearly 2 a.m., before authorities start calling people in Fountain Grove and telling them to evacuate. Then the fire rips across Highway 101, a 6-lane freeway that runs through the middle of the city. Residents on the other side of that freeway, in Coffee Park, a dense neighborhood well within Santa Rosa City proper, wake up to flames in the middle of the night.
The field is on fire. It's moving quick.
Ma'am, I need you to pause. Just a moment.
Okay.
I know you're scared. I'm sorry. I have to be short with you. We just have over 50 fires going on right now.
This fire has been headed toward their homes for 4 hours. But as Marisa and I found out, few people here get alerts of any kind.
Sonoma officials could have notified every single person with a cell phone in that area through the same kind of system that takes over your phone with those loud amber alerts. But that wasn't their procedure. Instead, they chose to send another type of alert to specific areas that reached fewer people. They did this in two ways: through text and emails, using a system that people have to sign up for ahead of time. The county doesn't know how many people got those warnings because it doesn't track that.
The following is a message from the Santa Rosa Emergency Operations Center.
They also made calls to people's landlines, but only a third of those got through on the first try.
Evacuate immediately.
CAL FIRE Battalion Chief Jonathan Cox says with fires moving 100 yards a minute, chewing through phone lines and downing cell phone towers, officials couldn't keep up.
It was one of those instances where the disaster was moving faster than literally people could communicate.
Up in the hills above Santa Rosa, the massive flame front has passed, leaving Greg and Christina Wilson, the couple who hid in their swimming pool, wet and freezing, their lungs burnt.
You know, I thought we would die.
Exhausted and no longer able to support herself, Christina lies on a narrow concrete ledge. The deck around her burned away hours ago.
You know, you're kind of in survival mode, and I'm not sure my brain's even thinking of anything else. It's just watching that house burn, and we're just hugging each other on the ground.
Then Greg hears something.
This low wail of a siren. And, I mean, it's just this low, quiet, and I'm like, honey, I think this thing's getting closer. And at that point, I got up, and I'm talking like this, but I'm just waving, screaming, hey.
The Wilsons are saved by chance. One of their neighbors managed to call a cop she was dating, who got CAL FIRE to save them. Rescuers drive the Wilsons to a hospital.
The last thing I remember, Christina was lying on a gurney. I was lying on a gurney with Max, and there was a nurse there saying, okay, I'm going to take Maximus. And then they said, and then we're going to knock you out.
Greg and Christina, covered in burns, are put into a medically induced coma. Nurses have to move them to another facility because even the hospital catches fire. Their dog, Max, is alive but is nearly blind.
I have to say I'm very impressed with my wife. She didn't panic at all. I mean, the only thing you're worried about, you know, is her.
You know, you just kind of do what you do to survive, and we wanted her to live. So.
At this point, firefighters still aren't even thinking about putting out blazes. They're just trying to save as many people as they can. But there are only so many firefighters. And that mutual aid system, where neighboring counties tap each other when they need help, CAL FIRE's Annalee Berlew says it's breaking.
Sonoma's depleted. They have a major fire going. They call Napa. Napa has a major fire going. They don't have any resources to send. They call Lake. Lake County is depleted. They have a major fire going. So they call their closest neighbor, Mendocino. Mendocino has a major fire going. They don't have any resources to send.
Berlew doesn't have anyone left to draw from. And that map in her war room, there are so many fires, she's all out of magnets. She's using Post-it notes instead. And the nearest additional firefighters are hours away.
All these counties that are touching each other, because that's where the weather event went through, right, are all impacted with their own disaster.
That weather event means more counties are getting hit by hurricane-force gusts of up to 80 miles per hour. And people are continuing to call 911, reporting electrical problems, surging power lines, and explosions. And they're not just sparking new fires. They're preventing first responders from doing their job because they're not supposed to touch or even drive over a power line until electrical workers can guarantee the line is dead. We ask Unit Chief Berlew why CAL FIRE didn't consider asking the utility to shut down the power grid.
That is not something that we have historically done.
But CAL FIRE can do this. They do it in Southern California. CAL FIRE's Jonathan Cox says it's just not procedure in this part of the state.
Our world that we operate in is very procedurally driven, policy and procedurally driven, right? We're one cog here in the large California cog wheel.
This decision may have proven critical as the fire spread north to Mendocino County.
Vegetation fire, power lines down.
1822, I have two calls pending. One of them is power lines down across the road.
Remember that Highway 101 running through Santa Rosa? If you follow it 70 miles north, the towns start getting further apart, the farmlands more spaced out. In the early morning hours, a woman in a small town called Redwood Valley finds herself surrounded by fire. She calls 911.
Do I need to evacuate my house and kids?
I don't know, ma'am. If it's that close...
Throughout the night, this is a pattern. 911 operators can't give people clear directions on which way to flee. They tell them to shelter in place, to wait for a knock on the door, to drive through flames. Nobody seems to know what to do.
I've been trying to call 911 for the last 15 minutes and nobody's answered.
Ma'am, I understand. There's a lot of fires all over the county, so the best thing I can do is take whatever action you feel is necessary and appropriate, okay?
Okay, can you tell me, who do I call to find out how close and where, what I need
no
to do?
No one. No one, ma'am. Literally, there are multiple fires in the county right now. We're sending
just down the road from this caller, Redwood Valley Fire Chief Brendan Turner is directing his crews, trying to get residents to safety. He's pulled over at the bottom of a gated dirt driveway, making calls for more fire engines. The smoke billows around him, making it hard to see. Then someone walks out of the darkness toward him.
He said he needed help. So I got him over to the back of my patrol, and at that point I was realizing that he had significant burns to his hand as well as his face. And I asked him his name, and he kind of cocked his head to the side, which the, Brendan, why are you asking me this? And that's when I realized that I knew whoever this person was. And when he told me his name... my heart just sank.
His name is John Shepard. He tells Turner that he got separated from his wife and two teenage kids. They're still up there in the fire.
You know, I I know his family very well. I've known his mom. I grew up with him. Know the whole family. And that was hard.
In a town as small as Redwood Valley, everyone knows each other. For his firefighters, those aren't just three victims up on the hill. They are their friends and neighbors.
This was another one of those areas where I was extremely concerned for the safety of the responders also, because they were, they were going to make it up that hill one way or the other.
Turner has to make an impossible decision.
And at one point, I had to kind of pull him back a little bit and say, we have to wait until this passes a little bit before we get up there. We're not able to help other people if we become victims.
As soon as the flames pass, Turner sends his firefighters up the hill. Among them, 23-year-old Garrett Johnson, who also knows the Shepherd family. Garrett finds the mom and her 17-year-old daughter, Cressa.
When we got up there, they were both conscious, alert, speaking with us. So I did have high hopes for them.
While they wait for an ambulance to arrive, Johnson and the other firefighters dress their burns and give them oxygen. It's still too dark and smoky to get a helicopter onto the valley floor to airlift them out.
The mother was slightly declining as we were taking her off the hill. From my assessment, I thought the daughter was the lesser of the two injuries. Turns out I was wrong.
The Shepherd parents survived with severe injuries. But Cressa, an aspiring artist and a junior in high school, underwent multiple surgeries and ultimately died at a hospital. Her 14-year-old brother, Kai, who loved wrestling and the San Francisco Giants, he didn't make it off the hill. As the sun rose that morning over Redwood Valley, Chief Brendan Turner was high up on the west side of the valley.
So I had a vantage point of basically the entire area on the valley floor that had burned. And it was surreal. It was hard to imagine what I was seeing. You know, again, it's the community that a lot of us have called home for a long time. And to witness that amount of devastation and still not know, how many people we had missing. It wasn't, it was gut-wrenching to see that.
The fires claimed 44 lives, injured hundreds of people, and burnt more than 9,000 buildings to the ground. They were the deadliest wildfires in state history. Until now. Just over a year later, Northern California's Camp Fire has been even deadlier. Marisa joins me with more. Hey, Marisa.
Hey, Al.
So, Marisa, first let's go back to the fires you reported on in the show. Again, it's been over a year. Do we know yet what sparked them?
Well, we don't know what sparked the biggest and deadliest, the Tubbs Fire, which was the one that hit the city of Santa Rosa. But in about 16 other cases throughout the northern part of the state, we do know that the electrical utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, is being blamed by state investigators. And in many of those cases, we also know that the state says that PG&E acted negligently in that they did not upkeep their electrical equipment to the standards they're expected to by law.
PG&E could have powered down portions of the electrical grid preemptively during extreme weather, but it wasn't company policy to do that. Has it changed at all in the last year?
Yeah, that's right. And this spring, PG&E did come out and say that they were changing their policy, that they now, in certain conditions where it's very hot and dry and the winds are very strong, they may, in some situations, tell residents that they could lose their power. And we actually did see them do that once this fall, but they did not do it in Butte County where the campfire broke out. And so there's questions being raised about whether that was the right decision. PG&E did report a disturbance on one of its big transmission lines very close to where firefighters believe the campfire started. That's led to a lot of speculation about whether PG&E did cause this latest fire and what it could mean for the utility's future.
President Trump just visited the fire zones in both Northern and Southern California. He pledged federal help. But Trump has also been critical of state leaders, blaming these fires on poor forest management. What should we make of that criticism?
For about 100 years, the state and federal officials really worked to aggressively suppress fires in wildlands. And what happens is that means a lot of dry fuel has built up over that time. But this is well beyond just a forest management problem in California. We've had really extreme drought conditions in California. The heat that we're seeing year-round, which many attribute to climate change. So to say that this is just an issue of cleaning up more dead brush and trees is to really oversimplify a problem that has just exploded in its magnitude over the last couple years.
Marisa, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Thanks for having me, Al.
Marisa Lagos is a reporter for KQED. She and her colleague Lisa Pickoff-White and Suki Lewis reported on last year's fire for us. We're going to keep investigating the effects of wildfires, including the smoky air that has blanketed much of California this year. If you had to get treatment for heart or breathing problems, or if you treated people for conditions related to smoke, get in touch with us. Just text the word FIRE to 63735. Again, text FIRE to 63735. You can text STOP at any time, and standard data rates apply. Back in a minute. This is Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Wildfires used to come around once a year, wildfire season. But lately, they're happening year-round. They're getting bigger and burning hotter. But there's another reason fires are getting deadlier and more destructive. It has to do with how and where we build. We want to share a story with you that we aired earlier this year, investigating what is now only the second most destructive fire in California history, the Tubbs Fire. It's the one that burned down the neighborhoods of Fountain Grove and Coffee Park last October. It killed 22 people and destroyed more than 5,000 buildings. Most of those buildings were in the city of Santa Rosa, but the fire started miles outside of town. It came through hills that, months later, are a mix of blackened oak and the first new shoots of green grass.
It's weird. It's like in a state of death and rebirth at the same time.
I drove out to a clearing between these hills to meet someone who saw the fire coming. His name is John Fouts. He's 70 years old, and since he was a kid, he's worked out here at his family's mountain home ranch, cabins and barns that were turned into a bed and breakfast and retreat center.
So John, what are we looking at here?
This was the lodge.
It was a three-story concrete house with a chimney made of petrified wood. Now it's just a chimney and a pile of twisted rebar and broken cement.
We just did the inventory, and boy, doing inventories really is a tearful thing, you know, because you, in your mind, walk into each room, okay, what was in there? Mm-hmm. And it was very emotional when they came and tore it down.
How long ago was that?
Maybe 2 weeks, a week, you know, recently.
Well, it's all fresh.
Yeah.
But as hard as it was to lose the ranch, it wasn't unexpected. Everyone in John's family trains to fight wildfires. They even have their own fire truck. Because the ranch, well, it's burned before.
This is the third time.
The first time was in the 30s, before John was born. But the second time was in 1964. This is a newsreel from back then.
The worst forest fires in the history of Northern California have laid waste a quarter of a million acres.
More than half a dozen buildings burned. But John, still in high school, was able to use water from a nearby swimming pool to help save the cabins his grandfather built. The 1964 fire and last year's Tubbs fire both started just a few miles from John's ranch, and both of them blew through the hills to Santa Rosa. In fact, if you draw an outline of the 1964 fire on a map, it's kind of eerie.
Right. And exactly the same pattern as the one this year. I mean, it burned almost identical.
But with one key difference. Even though these two fires burned the same land, the fire in the 1960s didn't kill anybody or burn nearly as many homes. And there's one obvious reason.
When the fires came through in the 60s, I'm sure that the community of Santa Rosa was not built up the way it is now.
There was almost nobody. In fact, Fountain Grove was not built. Coffee Park was a hayfield.
Coffee Park lost more than 1,400 homes in last year's fire. Fountain Grove lost more than 1,700.
And they'll be allowed to rebuild, and, you know, they're going to do it again, but that a fire will come again there.
Do you think it's crazy for them to rebuild there?
Yeah, I do. At least the way they had it.
The way they had it, Fountain Grove was a dense neighborhood of hilltop McMansions, with Santa Rosa at their feet and rolling mountains in the distance. But now, it's full of big yellow machines clearing the last chunks of McMansion off of cement foundations.
I mean, it looks like the type of ruins that you would see, like, in, in Greece or something.
Those ruins tell a story. If you know wildfires, like Reveal data reporter Eric Zagara.
You see down there, there's still an actual part of a building standing down there.
Yeah.
There's not a huge amount of space there.
If you're worried about wildfires, you want to keep plenty of space between you and anything that will burn. That means bushes and trees, but also other houses.
So if you have a huge house on a small lot, you don't have a whole lot of, like, space to clear and defend yourself.
And if bushes and houses are wildfire rocket fuel, this steep hillside is like a wildfire launch pad because heat rises. But if the fire risk here is so obvious, how did it all get built in the first place? For that, Eric and I pulled in Reveal's Patrick Michaels.
All right, so the development in Fountain Grove sort of begins in the early 70s when Hewlett-Packard wants to move up from Palo Alto and put a tech campus there.
This is the Hewlett-Packard HP65, the first fully programmable pocket-size calculator.
Hewlett-Packard built a campus on part of it, and the rest of it was basically worker housing. And that's what started this building spree out on the hillside. And sort of one after another, these master planned communities started popping up on the hills above Santa Rosa.
And Al, you can actually see this from the air.
That's Eric Zagara again.
And we have an animation here to show you how that growth looks.
Okay, so what am I looking at here?
So up here,
Eric shows me a time-lapse bird's eye view of Santa Rosa.
And if you look right where this dark spot is, that is Fountain Grove.
On those dark green hills, at the edge of the city, white dots and lines start appearing, their houses and streets. And in the late 90s, they take over.
That's a massive amount of growth in relatively a short period of time.
Right.
So, Eric, all of these houses are going up in a fire-prone wilderness area. Is that unique to this part of California?
No, it actually isn't. And it's actually pretty common throughout the country. This fire-prone area that we're talking about, the wildland-urban interface, this is where homes and vegetation kind of collide and mix together. In Sonoma County, the population in these areas grew by about 20% over the course of two decades. That's actually right at the national average.
And Patrick, what about the people who move into these type of houses? I mean, did they know about the fire danger?
Well, not really. We met with a woman named Susan Gorin, who moved in the 90s.
Welcome to the temporary permanent home while we rebuild.
Her own home had just burned down.
Those photos were rescued and that...
Her husband had a job at Hewlett-Packard, and she and her husband were both big outdoors people.
The natural beauty of Sonoma County is what really pulled us here. And then our family was growing and we need a larger house. Sadly, that house and that entire neighborhood is gone.
That was Fountain Grove?
That was in Fountain Grove.
And so living on this, you know, heavily treed hillside, that was really what they were there for.
An interesting fact is that one of the oak trees had been incorporated in the deck. In other words, the deck was built around the oak tree. And you could see the scars up the limbs of this very old oak tree. And it was from the Hanley fire 50 years ago.
That was her first clue that there had been any fire there before.
And I said, oh, well, that's an interesting piece of history. Okay. But it never dawned on me that it would be repeated. Was I aware of the fire risk then? Not as strongly as I am now, for sure.
So she's strongly aware of the fire risk now because her house burned down.
Well, right. But also because now she's a Sonoma County supervisor. And so in that job, part of her job is to use what she knows about fire risk to help determine what people build where in Sonoma County.
And how is she doing that? I mean, what is Susan Gorin doing about people who want to build homes in these fire-prone areas?
Well, we sat down with her and we asked her, if you can see a circumstance where wildfire risk on some land is just so extreme that you as a supervisor would feel
comfortable not allowing construction on there, period.
It's pretty hard for us, any decision maker, to say to any property owner that, sorry, we're not going to rebuild large swaths of Sonoma County. I think that is not, it is not fair to the homeowners, and it's not feasible for the policymakers.
What they're dealing with, apart from the immediate disaster of the fire, is that, you know, everyone who was displaced in the fire, those are all taxpayers as well. And so the city is facing a multi-million dollar shortfall in its budget. So they want to get people rebuilding, made whole, and back into their homes in Santa Rosa as quickly as possible. They even set up an office to expedite the permitting process for people who wanted to rebuild their homes. We visited there right when they were just putting it together, basically. You know, drilling the keyboards onto the desks.
It's really exciting.
There was a woman I talked to. She saw the devastation, and the way that she thought of to help was to join the permitting office so that she could help people with the paperwork to get their homes built as fast as they could.
The key to rebuilding is going to be streamlining permitting. Everybody understood that early on. We want somebody to rebuild on that property. We need that.
So it sounds like the local government's reaction to this devastating fire has actually been to accelerate building, to get people back in their homes.
And that's not a unique sentiment. I've actually covered multiple fires and the recovery process afterwards, and that instinct to rebuild and rebuild quickly is actually fairly common. But it's not just rebuilding. It's developers who are coming in and seeing opportunity in these scorched lots. Researchers have found evidence that suggests that new home construction can actually outpace rebuilding efforts after a wildfire.
Okay, so Is anything different happening when it comes to this new development?
Well, we didn't have to wait too long to see that, because almost immediately after the fire, there was a development called Round Barn Village. So before this building can get started, the city council needs to decide to change the land use from commercial to residential. But it would put about 237 townhomes in the hills sort of adjacent to Fountain Grove. So we actually went to check out the site where they're planning to build these homes, and it's an open field with a parking lot in the middle of it.
We'll stand under the shade of a birch tree.
When we got there, we met a city council member named Julie Combs.
What we're looking at is trees that have black bark. They still have branches, but the branches are all brown from being singed and scorched.
It was a really sort of just eerie sight. And she was saying that this is a place in particular that she didn't feel comfortable letting people build because she felt responsible for people.
We're not too far from the place where the fire jumped six lanes of highway and two access roads to burn down a Kmart. I have a lot of concerns about a residential project in this area. It always worries me to have people sleeping in a high fire hazard area.
So what happened when this new development came up in front of the city council?
All right, so this was the moment that we'd sort of been looking forward to throughout the reporting of this. This was the first big test of new development after the fire. So we went up there for the city council meeting. It started at 4. About 9:30, they got around to this question.
15.2, public hearing, Round Barn Village Project.
We heard from the developer.
All of your exteriors, your doors, your windows.
They described all of the fire-safe technology they were going to be using.
All glazed.
Scott Moon, the fire marshal from Santa Rosa, made the case that the new building standards in high fire-risk areas are so strong that...
And I think that will play into the resiliency of our community as we do move forward.
We can safely build homes now.
That seems to be the prevailing sentiment. Stuff like fire-resistant materials, double-pane windows, screens on your vents. But I'm not sure that building codes would have saved homes in this particular fire. About 94% of the homes that were built to the standards that fire marshal was talking about still burned. Our analysis found that there was 261 homes that had all these things in place. All but 16 of them were destroyed or damaged.
Despite that fact, The fire marshal's emphasis on new fire codes really seemed to sway some of the city council members at that meeting.
I'm happy to, with our discussion tonight and with those commitments, allow us to move on to the next step.
And there was just one city council member, Julie Combs, who stood her ground and said,
"We are setting a precedent to build more new housing in a fire hazard area when we vote today. I cannot support this item."
There was this anticlimactic moment where the clerk flips on the voting and the lights pop up, and it was 6 green ones and 1 red one.
That's a 6-1.
And that was it. They approved it, and we're on to the next order of business.
I move a resolution of the council of the city of Santa Rosa.
So after the city council vote and Julie Combs, she was the one against 6. What was her reaction?
Why are you still here?
We caught up with her after the meeting, you know, kind of right outside, and what she said she was thinking about was taking the big view.
This is only the first new housing development. It's not the last. We're going to see more development, more housing proposed for the fire hazard area. And we just blinked. So the next group is going to say, well, you let them go. So why aren't you letting us go?
We just witnessed how it happens.
You just witnessed the process of, we've given up the ability to prevent any kind of increased density of housing in a fire hazard area. We just gave it up, and we've given it up until the next fire.
So, Eric, you said earlier that homes are getting built in fire-prone wilderness areas all over the country. In Santa Rosa, they're now putting even more houses there right after a major fire. Is the rest of the country doing the same thing as Santa Rosa?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I would say so. And we've seen this in areas like Tennessee, Oklahoma, South Carolina. These are all places that have lost homes to fires over the past few years. And new houses are being built. They're rebuilding in places that have burned before. And it's entirely possible that they're going to burn again. The other thing we know is that fires are actually going to increase in severity and frequency throughout the country, not just in the western states. So we can expect to see this story again and again and again.
That's Reveal's data reporter Eric Segarra and Patrick Michaels. That story was produced by Stan Alcorn. Brett Myers edited today's show. Thanks to KQED's Sonia Hudson and Peter Acuni for additional reporting on these stories. Samantha Fields helped produce today's show. And also, thanks to Gay LeBaron. Our production manager is Mwende Inahosa. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help from Kat Chuknet. Thanks to Dan Bergren and Sleeping Giant Records for additional music in this episode. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Ledzin, and remember, there is always more to the story.